Roy Hoosier, and I'm a grateful alcoholic. Before I get started, no, I'll keep it. Before I get started, I want to thank the committee and every person in this room for the hospitality, the fellowship, the warmth that I've received since I got here. This has been a fantastic weekend. I've had a great time. This is not water. This is gin. You can get a little fire in your thing with a little sip of gin. It'll give you a little fire. There was this old minister who was retiring from this church. He'd been there a long time. And they hired a new young man right out of school to take his place. And they asked the old minister if he would stay and sort of coach the young guy. And he agreed. And so the first Sunday, the young man made a great talk, first sermon. And the old minister called him aside afterwards and said, "Son, you did a great job." But he said, "This congregation likes a little fire and brimstone. They like a little energy." And he said, "You see that water pitcher up there? Well, I fill it up with gin. And I sip on it through the sermon. It adds a little fire in the sermon." So the next week, the young minister put the gin in his water pitcher, and he sipped on it through the sermon. Made a hell of a talk. He called him, the old minister called him aside afterwards and said, "Son, that was a great, great sermon. Said, you got this crowd, you got this congregation where you want them. But I think you took a little too much of that gin." Said, "You misquoted a little scripture. Said, the book says that David slew Goliath. He didn't take a rock and beat hell out of the son of a bitch." I again thank the committee for having me out here. This has been great. I've enjoyed this. I've had a great time. I've met a lot of nice people. I'm a grateful alcoholic. I'm a big book drunk. I believe in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, and the program that's laid out in that book is the only means of recovery from the terminal illness that you and I have. Now, we're going to talk a little about AA, and I'm going to tell you my story. That's all I know to do. I had my first drink when I was 16 years old, sitting in a car with two friends. Now, in North Carolina, back in those days, we had beer on the curb. I don't know whether y'all did here or not. We could drive a car up, and the curb pop would come out, and you'd order what you wanted. And we pulled into this place, and the curb pop said, "What do you want?" And the driver said, "I want a Miller High Life." And the guy sitting in the right-hand seat said, "I want a Miller High Life." And he looked at me, and I said, "Miller High Life." And I ordered that because I didn't know any other brands. I was 16 years old. I came from a teetotal family. Nobody in my family drank. I didn't know anything about alcohol. I had a couple of drunk uncles that I admired because they seemed to have more fun than my daddy did. But I didn't know anything about it. And I sat in that car and drank that one beer with these two guys. And I don't know that one beer made that much difference in my life, but for the first time in my life, I felt a part of. I had been a square peg in a round hole for so many years. For the first time in my life, I felt a part of. Now, it's been over 60 years since I had that drink. I still remember what that feeling felt like. I can almost remember what that beer tastes like. What I can't remember is who the other two guys were. I think I know, but I'm not sure. I continued to drink all the way through high school and sometimes to excess, but I was not alcoholic. My wife and I ran off the old bag that you were talking about. She and I ran off and got married when we were in high school. We came in heat same time. We fell in love later. Last February, we were married 59 years. Thank you. And I love her to death, and we have a great time. She makes a hell of an Al-Anon talk, and we've had a lot of fun going around the country talking. But anyway, we ran off and got married, and I was a senior in high school. She was a junior. And I finished up school that year, and she went back the next year as a senior, and I signed her report cards. Last time I've ever had any control in that house. I went in the Army when I was 20 years old, and if there's such a thing as crossing that invisible line from normal drinking to alcoholism, it occurred with me in the Army. Because it was here that I discovered I didn't drink like other people. I was thrown in with guys from all over the country, people who had grown up in bars and taverns and this type of thing all their life. Drinking was just something they did. It was not an event. Drinking to me was an event. And I learned quickly that I could not predict what was going to happen when I took a drink. And I could not take a drink and quit. I had to run the gamut. Everything that occurred in my life during that period of time was eventful as hell, but it was different. And I had blackouts while I was in service. I didn't know what a blackout was until I came in this program. And you told me that alcoholics are the only one who have blackouts. Social drinkers don't have blackouts. I had them before they became popular. I'll tell you about one of them. I was making $84 a month. This is back in the 50s, and I was in Europe. I'm making $84 a month. I was sending $40 a month home to Peggy, so I didn't have a whole lot of money, but you didn't take a lot of money over there. I had a poker game or won a baseball pool or something. I went up with $300. And in 1957, $300 was a hell of a lot of money in Europe. You could get a meal for 25 cents. And I decided I was going to Paris. So I put in for a 10-day leave. They gave it to me. I got my $300, packed a little ditty bag, and went downtown to have a few drinks with the boys and catch a train to Paris the next morning. Had a few drinks with the boys, went to bed. Woke up the next morning, didn't have my money. Roll was gone. Didn't know where it was. Looked all over the room. Couldn't remember what I did last night. Went downstairs where the guys were drinking breakfast and tried to find out what I did. And it was just normal. They said, you came to town, you had a few drinks, you got drunk, went to bed. But I didn't have my money. So you don't go to Paris. I had $3. You don't go to Paris on $3. So I turned my leave back in, went back to work. A month later, I'm out in the field with this lieutenant, and we went into this little German guest house to have a beer. And the people lived in the rear of the building. And the door was open, or curtain was side or something. And I looked, and there was an old iron bed back there in their bedroom. And I remembered what I'd done with my money. I'd stuck it up the leg of that bed. I'd never done that before in my life, and I haven't done it since. So if you think losing $300 will drive you crazy, how about knowing where it is and can't get to it? A couple of weeks later, I got in back into town and went in this old hotel. And it had this book. It had to sign in when you went in, and I found out the room I was in. And this book was quite interesting. It was a GI book. And you'd look at a GI hotel. You'd look down, and it'd say, Donald and Daisy Duck. Mickey and Minnie Mouse. But the best one they had was Dwight and Mamie Eisenhower. $1 a night. I found the hotel I was in. I went upstairs. I found a bed. I dug my money out of the leg of that bed and promptly lost it in the poker game and never did make it to Paris. I got out of service, and I used to be a bricklayer. My uncles taught me how to lay brick when I was a kid. And I went back to work on the line, and I told my wife, I said, you know, this guy's on that line 30 years old, can't even stand up. You know, they've been over all day long. And I don't want to do that the rest of my life. And so we decided I'd go to college. And I took a full-time job and went to school full-time. And my wife took a part-time job with her full-time job, and we put me through school. Now, if there was a period of time when I didn't drink, it was when I was in college. Very little, because we didn't have any money. We were poor. P-O-R-E, poor. There were nights, cold nights, when I would crawl under the car and drain the radiator and fill it back up the next morning before we went to work, because we didn't have the money for antifreeze. And so I didn't drink much, but any time I got the opportunity, I got drunk. I got out of school. I took a job as a traveling salesman. I'd always wanted to be a traveling salesman. Ever since I found out what a traveling salesman does, they wear nice clothes, they stay in nice hotels, they drive nice cars, they drink good liquor, they make a lot of money, they don't work much. That was my idea. So I took a job with a cement company. They hired me to sell mortar mix and cement because I was a bricklayer. And they moved me to Roanoke, Virginia. And I go up there, and I have a job. I got an expense account and a little car and company car, and I go into this building supply company, and it's supposed to be handling our product. And he said, "We don't handle that, Roy." I said, "The contractors won't buy it." And so I go see the contractors, and they said, "Well, we don't buy it because the bricklayers won't use it." And I go out and see the bricklayer, and they say, "I ain't using that sorry damn stuff." And so I had a product, nothing. We had a few little sales, but it wasn't much. So I decided I learned something about myself. I can change your perception. And so I would go in the mornings. I'd call on the architects and the building supply firms, and I'd go home at lunch, change clothes, and get into my work clothes and get my tools, and go pick up 3 or 4 bags of my mortar mix and go out on a job, give the mortar mixer the $5. They mix up my stuff, and here's the way I want you to do it. I'd crawl up on the scaffold with my tools, and the guy say, "What the hell are you doing here?" I'm going to lay brick. "Well, I ain't paying you." "Well, that's all right." So I'd lay brick all afternoon. And then we'd go to the beer joint, and I'd buy him beer and tell jokes. And hell, I started selling mortar mix. An old dealer called me one day and said, "Roy, send me a truckload." And I had 2 bricklayers in here this morning. Both of them won 50 bags of Roy's mortar mix. I didn't even know what the name of it was. I left that job after a couple of years and moved back to North Carolina, and I went to work for a company that wanted me to spend their money. They were making a lot of money, and back in the 60s, everything that you spent was tax deductible. Not that way today. And this company was making tons of money. They manufactured school buses. And I sold school buses in the South and the West. I worked everything in the South, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, Florida, South Carolina, all these things, Tennessee. And then I jumped over the river and I worked everything, you know, Oklahoma, Texas, Arizona, California, Nevada, Washington, Oregon, Alaska, everything. And I was gone all the time. And they said, "Fly first class." And I did. And they said, "When you go into town, stay in the nicest hotel. When you entertain, take them to the nicest restaurant and give them the best liquor." And I took them up on it. Yeah. And I started drinking, and I credit this company with allowing me to get into full-fledged alcoholism early. And I'll give you an example of what would take place. I'd leave home on Monday. I'd go to the airport, get on the plane. We'd be going to Atlanta, Chicago. And if here come the cart, and I'd have a couple of drinks. You know, I'd get to Chicago, and I'd go into the bar and have 3 between planes. And I'd catch a plane to Denver, and we'd have a couple on the plane on the way to Denver. And the guy in Denver would pick me up at the airport, and of course you got to have a couple of drinks before the bags come down. And then we'd go to his office for an hour and go to lunch and have a couple of drinks and a beer with a sandwich. Go back and work a couple of hours at his office, leave early for happy hour. Have 5 or 6 at happy hour, go to dinner, have a couple of drinks. He'd go home and I'd close the bar down. This is Monday. And I did this every day. I'd come home on Friday night drunk. Now, you don't drink the way I drink and come home and quit. You know, you're like this. So I had to drink all weekend. And invariably, I would embarrass myself. I embarrassed my family, my friends, and I quit drinking every Monday morning. I would leave home and I would say to myself, "This week I'm not going to drink. I'm going to stay sober. I'm going to come home Friday night. I'm going to be a husband and a father and a neighbor and a friend, and I'm not going to do what I did this past weekend." And I meant every damn word of it. And I'd get out to the airport and I'd get on the plane, and here'd come that little cart, and the girl would say, "You want a Bloody Mary or a screwdriver?" 7 o'clock in the morning. "You know, I don't know. Give me one of each." I could not not drink. Our book's got the best description of me that I've ever heard. We're on a merry-go-round and we can't get off. That was exactly where I was. I was on a merry-go-round and I couldn't get off. I knew I had a problem with alcohol 5 years before I ever heard of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I didn't know what to do about it. I really didn't want to quit because I told you I felt out of place all my life. I had been a square peg in a round hole. I didn't want to go back to that. And that's the only two options I knew. So I didn't want to quit. In 1968, I was at a convention in Lake Charles, Louisiana, and I had a competitor down there, vice president of another company. He knew my management and sales skills, and I had them. I was a good manager, and I was a good salesman. And Bill knew my skills, and he said, Roy, he didn't know about my drinking. He said, Roy, why don't you go to work for me? And I said, Bill, why don't you make me a deal? And he made me a deal, and I went to work for a company out of Arkansas that made school buses, manufactured school buses. They built a plant in Northeast, and we moved to Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania. It's the pothole capital of the world, but it's the greatest people I've ever met. They're the finest people. They have treated us really well. We moved to Beaver Falls. My wife didn't want to go. She had her friends and her family and her roots and her home and everything in High Point, and she didn't want to go to Pennsylvania with a drunk husband. And I don't blame her. But I'm a good salesman, and she loved me. And we decided that she agreed to go, and I told her, this, you know, it'd be different. I won't be traveling so much. I'm a sales manager. I'll be in the office. And so she went, and I didn't drink a drop first day till after lunch. But nothing changed. Same thing all the time. We had some people up there that were selling our product. I didn't know, and I had a list of the names and phone numbers. So I called this guy in Washington, Pennsylvania. His man was named Ned Hunter. And I told him who I was, and he had heard that I was a new man. And he said, come on down, and we'll visit. And so I went down, and I found out he was very capable of doing what we had him to do. He was a distributor, but he knew the product. He worked, he did a very good job, and he was part of, you know, I was happy to have him. And we went to lunch, and the girl said, what do you guys want to drink? And I said, I'll have a martini. And Ned said, I'll take an iced tea. I thought, oh, God, here's a guy that don't drink at lunch. I had quit associating with people who didn't drink at breakfast. He don't drink at lunch. So, what do you want to eat? And I said, I want a sandwich and a beer. And he said, I'll take a sandwich and another glass of tea. On subsequent visits, he never drank. We had a big convention over in Philadelphia, and I was going to set up a hospitality suite, and he said, you want me to go in 10 bar? And I said, yeah, come on. He went with me to Philadelphia, set up till 2 in the morning. He poured drinks. He told stories. It was the life of the party. He didn't take a drink. Up there, somebody told me Ned used to drink, no longer drinks. That's all I knew. A few months later, he and I on a plane out of Pittsburgh going to the home office in Little Rock. The cart comes down the aisle, and the girl says, what do you want? And I said, 2 bourbons and 7 up. And Ned said, give me 2 bourbons and 7 up. It caught my attention. Man don't drink. Ordering booze. They set them out there in little miniature bottles, and he took the miniature bottles and put them over on my tray. Here, Roy, I'll give you 4. I'll just drink the 7 up. I said, Ned, you don't drink at all, do you? This guy had read the book Alcoholics Anonymous. He had read the chapter Working with Others. And when I opened the door, he stuck his foot in. I got a 12-step call at 30,000 feet. Now, I knew that that was important. I knew that conversation was important. I had this problem running around. I was drinking too much, and I knew it, but I knew that conversation was important. I didn't question him too much because I suspected there was some not drinking involved. And I wasn't ready for that. Anyway, it appears to me today, and I know it for a fact, that I went to Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania not to sell buses. That was not my purpose for going up there. God sent me to Pennsylvania to learn about Alcoholics Anonymous. And the way I know that today is because the minute I knew the two words, Alcoholics Anonymous, and somebody in the program, my purpose for being in Pennsylvania was over with and I got fired. I'm going to give you a piece of advice. They don't ever work for anybody from Arkansas. They're narrow-minded. If you don't work, they won't pay you. I got fired. I forgot to tell y'all, my sobriety date's March 15th, 1972. I forgot to tell you that. And I got a home group, and I got a sponsor. My sponsor got 57 years. A lot of people in this room know Tom. Anyway, when I got fired, we moved back to North Carolina, and I went and visited my brother-in-law. He and I bought his daddy's little upholstery shop. It wasn't much of a thing. We had four or five employees. It was not very big. And to show you how small it was, my brother-in-law was the president of the company, and he did all the cloth cutting. I was vice president of sales and marketing, and I loaded trucks. That's how small it was. And it wasn't big enough for two families, much less two. But it didn't matter because I wasn't there anyway. I stayed drunk all the time. In November 1970, I came to laying on the floor. My family was gone. My wife probably worked. I don't know. I was laying on the floor, and my stomach was saying, "Why'd you do it? Why'd you do it? Why'd you do it?" And I didn't know why I did it. I didn't know what I did. The only thing I could remember was last night was bad. I'd had no details. I just knew it was bad. I remembered Ned Hunter and what he had told me. And I called on the phone and I said, "Ned, I think I got a drinking problem." And he chuckled and said, "Roy, everybody that's ever known you knows you got a drinking problem." And we're all thrilled to death that you finally found it out. And once more he told me what happened to him. And he said, "Call Alcoholics Anonymous in High Point and do what they tell you to do." I called AA that day and I got a hold of a guy that would be my first sponsor later. And he said, "I'm tied up, Roy," and I gave him. I don't think I even gave him the right name. "But I'm going to send a man out to see you. Where you live?" Well, I lived at Route 2, Box 167. It's hard to tell somebody that. So I had an office, had a street address. I hadn't been there in 3 weeks, but it was important that I go. And I told him I'd meet him at the office at 2 o'clock or something, and he said he'd send a man out. And I called Peggy and told her I'd called A&A, and they were going to solve all their problems, and she thought that was a great idea. And on the way down there, I stopped at the South Main Texaco. We had a great big Texaco sign. Ain't sold gas in 20 years. It's a bar. And I got me a couple of beers, and we didn't have liquor but the drink. But George had a bottle under the counter, and he poured me a couple of shots, and I sort of smoothed out. I got to the plant, and I dug in an old cotton barrel, found a vodka bottle, and I thought maybe I'd panicked early. Y'all know the feeling. I don't know whether I'm going to do this or not, you know. And a man walked in my office, and his name was Jack Brown, and when Jack walked in my office, I knew Alcoholics Anonymous would work. I had known Jack Brown all my life. Jack came in my office. He was not the person I used to know. I didn't know what happened, but I knew he was not the person I used to know. Had no wine sores, hair was combed, had a tie on, he was working, never had a job before. I'll give you Jack finally had a heart attack and died in an AA meeting. It's a hell of a good way to go. I just don't want to do it today. But when Jack came in and he sat down and began to tell me what happened, and my wife brought sliding into this remarkable thing. And Jack told me what was happening, what had happened to him, and he said, "Roy, I think y'all need to go to an AA meeting with me." And I said, "Jack, I think so too. And if you tell me where they are, in the next couple of weeks I'll try to drop by." And he said, "No, it don't work that way." He said, "I want you to go with me to a meeting tonight." And I said, "There's no way I can go to a meeting tonight, Jack." And my wife said, "What have you got to do tonight?" And The only thing I had to do tonight was drink, and I didn't want to tell her that. So I appreciated Jack coming to see me. I was inquisitive about what happened to him, and because I could not go come up with an answer, I went to my first AA meeting in November 1970. And I walked into a group, and the people shook my hand, they patted me on the back, they gave me a cup of coffee, they told me they were glad I was there, and I knew they meant it. I felt comfortable in Alcoholics Anonymous the first day I walked in there. And I have never been uncomfortable at an AA meeting since. Now, there were a couple of parts of AA that I went to meeting. We didn't have a two a week in High Point. I went to all of them for a while. But there was a couple of parts of AA I didn't really like. I liked a lot about AA, but I didn't like that God part. And I didn't like that not drinking. If you take God and not drinking out of AA, there's a hell of a lot left, you know. But I went to all of the meetings, both of them. And we started another meeting. I'll tell you about that in a little bit. But I would get drunk. I'd stay sober 6 weeks, and I'd get drunk. And I'd stay drunk as long as I could. And then I'd come back to AA, and they'd pat me on the back and shake my hand and give me a cup of coffee, or a half cup. And tell me that they were glad I was back, and they hoped that I would stay. And I knew that they meant it. In and out, in and out, in and out. And the thing that I learned during this period of time was the insanity part. Insanity occurs to us when we're cold sober, like we are this morning. It's not when we're drinking. It's when I take a drink after the tragic past and the history, and not remember what happened to me last week or the week before. Don't remember I got out of jail, my wife left me, I got fired. I don't remember all that stuff. I remember that feeling of comfort and contentment that I got with the first drink. And so I'll take a drink, and what would happen to me? I would be coming home from work. And with no forethought, nothing, I would just pull into Smitty's and get a draft beer. Probably been to a meeting Sunday night. And Smitty said, "Roy, you want another one?" I said, "No, I got to go home and cut my grass." And I'd leave. Go home and cut my grass. Tuesday, on the way home from work, I would remember I had a beer yesterday. Let's say in AA, you're the first one to get you drunk. Well, I had the first one to get me drunk. They say once you start, you can't stop. Nah, I stopped. And I began to think, well, I want to rationalize. Maybe I'm not alcoholic. Maybe mixing that scotch and that ripple wine together is what did it last time. Or I really began to think, you know, alcoholism is illness. Illnesses are curable. Hell, I've been to 32 meetings. I might be cured. And so to prove to myself that I was not alcoholic, I wouldn't even drink a beer on Tuesday. Go home. Wednesday, sitting in my office, 2 o'clock. I would remember I had a drink. I had a beer Monday. And I remember that I used my willpower on Tuesday not to drink. And I said, I bet I can get a draft beer this afternoon. It won't bother me. At that point, the obsession would set in, and it would be so strong I couldn't do anything else the rest of the afternoon but think about getting one beer at 5 o'clock. And it would be so strong I would leave at 4 to go get a draft beer. And on the way to Smitty's, I would convince myself that not only can I have a draft beer, I can get a king size to go. And at 4:30, I would leave Smitty's with a bag with king size after having drank a draft with a king size in a bag. And the next thing I know, it'd be Monday again. I'd be in jail in South Carolina. And every time they gave me my belt back, I knew I couldn't drink. And every time I got fired from a job, I knew I couldn't drink. And every time I woke up on the floor and everything about me was gone and my family was gone, I knew I couldn't drink. But somewhere between there and the here, I had to take a drink. Our book got another descriptive part that I really like. No human power can relieve my alcoholism. God could and would if he were sought. That's the answer to our problem. I didn't know that, so I had no choice but to drink. And today when I'm working with people and they go out and have drinks, have slips, I understand. I know they have no choice but to drink. And I say, I hope you make it back, and I hope you find God so you can have sobriety like me. But anyway, I want to tell you about this group we founded. I was hanging around with a bunch of losers. We had a bunch of us in there, in and out. And I'd get drunk, and I'd call Ken or Sam or some of them. They'd come over and talk to me. And the reason they did it was because they knew that next week they was going to be drunk, and I'd be sober, and I'd go talk to them. It was just, you know, a bunch of losers. And we didn't like that group where they were paying their bills and telling the truth. So we decided to start our own group. And the other people in town wouldn't come to it. They called it Slippers Anonymous. But we formed this group, and one Sunday night there were 9 of us at a meeting. And somebody at another group had picked up a three-year chip or something. He can't stay sober 3 years. He don't pills or something. You know, we bad-mouthing the old boy. Somebody said, who's got the most sobriety here? And we counted up, and so help me God. 9 of us in that meeting, and we had 11 days between us. And the next night, we were all drunk. But let me tell you about that thing. Let me tell you how Alcoholics Anonymous works for losers. Joe Mickey died drunk. Carol Martin died drunk. E.T. Lewis died drunk. Les died drunk. Darlene, I don't know where Darlene went. Nobody knows. Nobody ever knew her. She's disappeared. Walt stayed sober over 20 years before he died sober. Paul stayed sober over 25 years before he died sober. Ken stayed sober over 30 years before he died sober, and I'm still here. For 4 of that group to stay sober over 20 years is a miracle. And thank God AA works for losers. On March 15, 1972, I came to laying on the floor. And I stole these words from another speaker. He said I could use them. But this is the way I felt. I woke up that morning and I realized that everything I had was gone. It should be gone, and I didn't deserve to have it back. That's how I felt that morning. And I called out to a God that I didn't believe in. I said, God, if there is a God, I need help. And my whole life changed in a fraction of a second. I was enveloped with the greatest feeling of peace and contentment that I have ever known in my life. It didn't last long, but it lasted long enough to where everything in my life changed. I realized then that there was a God. There always had been. It was me that was wrong. I realized that morning that I was alcoholic, and I had been for years. And I knew that the answer to my problem that day, and somehow I knew that the answer to every problem I would ever have, would be in the people and or the program Alcoholics Anonymous. I have been sober over 42 years, and everything that's ever occurred to me has been solved by the people and or the program Alcoholics Anonymous. And the beautiful thing that happened to me that morning, that I didn't realize till later, that insane belief that I can drink was taken from me. I didn't do it. I was sober 3 months, and I went up to get a 3-month chip, and I realized on the way up there that I no longer believed, I no longer wanted to drink. And it occurred to me again at 6 months and a year, and every year when I go up to get my chip, I realize that I have had the grace of the lack of insanity, or I've been sane for all these years, and I didn't do it. That night I went back to AA. And I went back to where I was supposed to go. And I said to Joe, who was sort of the granddaddy of that group, hey, Joe, I want to stay sober. Will you help me? And Joe told me later that he recognized or saw something in me that night he hadn't seen before. And he began to show me how to apply the principles of this program to my life. He began to show me how the steps of this program would change my life. And he began to do the things that a sponsor's supposed to do. And he laid a foundation in me that is still there. And the group took me in. The group became, I became part of that group. They let me wash ashtrays. They let me wash coffee cups. They taught me how to make coffee. They let me read the steps. They let me read the traditions when they were assured I could pronounce anonymity. And I began to chair meetings. And the beautiful thing they did for me, they started taking me with them on 12-step calls. Now, back in the 72, we made a lot of 12-step calls. We didn't have the detox centers and the halfway house. We didn't have that back then. And thank God we got them now. Because 12-step calls, we were sober and drunks up with alcohol and paraldehyde. And it's called practicing medicine without a license. That's what. And we did all that. And they told me if I wanted to keep this, I had to give it away. And so I was chasing after drunks so that I could stay sober. And we had an old minister came to town and said that God had sent him down there from Wisconsin to help drunks. And he had an old house there, and he stayed 15 years, and when he left, he knew no more about helping drunks than he did to start with. But he kept them fed, and he kept them clothed, and he kept them warm, and he kept them safe. And he gave us a place to take a drunk. And all of his money came from church contributions. And so he called me one night and he said, "Roy, I got a meeting with the church and Rudy's in DTs. Will you come sit with him?" And I knew Rudy. Hell, everybody in town knew Rudy. And incidentally, before I forget it, Rudy died sober. So I go over there and Rudy's seeing, he's seeing snakes or boogers. So I don't know what he's seeing. He's covered up. And rats, and so I get a chair and a fly swatter, and I sit in beside his bed. And he sees a rat or a snake, and he screams, and I take that fly swatter and hit where he's pointing. And whatever he's seeing goes away. And I sat there and beat the boogers off Rudy all night. And somewhere in the wee hours of the morning, it became important to me that Rudy get well. For the first time in my life, I cared more for somebody else than I did for myself. And my life changed. And I have never gone to help a drunk so that I can stay sober. I'm interested in your sobriety. I've been sober about a year and a half, and I got a chance to go back on the road. I'd burned a lot of bridges. Nobody wanted to hire me. And a man gave me a chance. And I left him after about 4 or 5 years because we had some hard feelings and I didn't like the way he did business and it wasn't the right way I wanted it. And I left him. But I had the opportunity to go sit down with him before he died and tell him I appreciated him giving me a chance. But I went to work for this company and I said to Joe, I said, "Joe made me go to meetings every night. And we only had 2 or 3 a week in High Point, but I go to Winston and Greensboro." And I said, "Joe, I don't know whether I can go to meeting every night or not. I'm traveling." He said, "They got meetings in other towns." And he said, "Here's what you do. You get into a town you're going to spend the night. You check in the hotel. You get the book out and you call Alcoholics Anonymous. Find out where the meetings are. And you have something to eat and you go to that meeting. And if they got more than one meeting, you go the next time you're there, go to the other meeting. Find the one that you like the best. And that's your home group out of town." And so I had home groups in Roanoke and Richmond and Norfolk and Baltimore and Hagerstown and Bowie. That was where I traveled in Virginia and Maryland. And I had home groups everywhere. My schedule changed and I missed Bowie one time and 2 people called me to see if I was all right. But I started traveling for that company, and then I left them after about 5 years, went to another company, stayed 20 years, and retired. But I want to tell you the story about the first company. They took us on a sales trip to western Pennsylvania, south of Erie, I don't know what the name of it is. And we were going to a factory where they were making product that we sold. And we had an agenda. We were going to be there for about a week, and we had an agenda of what we were going to do. And the last night we were there, we were going to have a cocktail party and a banquet. Well, Joe had died, and I'd got another sponsor, but I sat down with Frank and Jack, 2 old-timers in my group, and I said, "Guys, I got to have a cocktail party, and I've only been sober a couple of years, and I don't do well at cocktail parties, and I'm afraid." And Jack says, "If you're spiritually fit, you can go anywhere you want to." And I said, Jack, I understand that, and I want to be, but I don't know if I'm spiritually fit enough to go to a cocktail party. And old Frank said, let me give you some advice, Bubba. Go tell that bartender, get there early and tell that bartender you're on the wagon. He'll understand. Tell him to give you a glass of ginger ale and put some fruit in it. You know, orange slices or something. And sip on it. Nobody cares whether you drink it or not. So I made it through the cocktail party. Just fine. Sat down for dinner and they had red wine poured at everybody's place. Joe sitting next to me, an old boy that worked over in Hickory. He can drink, don't bother him. So he drank his wine, put the empty glass in front of me, took mine. Fine. Waiter comes by with a white towel and the wine. I said no, and he walked on. Got through with dinner, and the lady whose husband was hosting this was right across the table from me, and her name was Mrs. Green. And I heard her tell the waiter, bring everybody Irish coffee. And I said to the waiter, just bring me regular coffee. Irish coffee is coffee with Irish whiskey in it and whipped cream on top. Bring me regular coffee. This caught her attention, and she said, Roy, you ought to try the Irish coffee. It's the best Irish coffee you ever drank. And I said, Miss Green, I'm sure that's true, and I appreciate it, but I don't want any. I don't want regular coffee. She said, no, you got to try one. She told the waiter, said, bring him one too. I realized what Jack and Frank and Joe and all these guys have been trying to tell me. There comes a time when you have to decide whether you want to be mildly embarrassed or dead. What it amounts to. So I said to the lady as quietly as I could, but loud enough so she wouldn't misunderstand. I said, Miss Green, I'm an alcoholic. If I drink that Irish coffee, I'll tear this goddamn restaurant down. Now, I've told that story all over the country, and it's funny and all that, but that song got a second verse. 18 years ago, I'm in Atlanta, walking at a big machinery show, and I'm walking the halls, and I heard a voice say, hey, Roy. And I turned around, and there's Cully. I hadn't seen Cully in 20 years. He worked for the same company. He was in Mississippi, worked in Mississippi. I hadn't seen Cully in 20 years. We shook hands and exchanged cards. And he said, you got time for a coffee? I said, sure. And went over and sat down in a little old snack bar, and he said, been hoping I'll run into you, could run into you somewhere. He said, you remember when we went on that trip in Pennsylvania? Yeah. You remember that woman tried to get you to drink that Irish coffee? Yeah. You remember what you told her, Roy? I said, yeah, Cully. I can't tell Cully. I've been telling that damn story for 15 years. Yeah, Cully, I remember what I said. He said, Roy, I was sitting down about three seats from you, and I heard what you said, and I was impressed. He said, I had been impressed all week the way you conducted yourself. He said, I was alcoholic then, and I didn't know it. And he said, years later, when I ran out of everything and everybody, I said, God, if you give me what you gave Roy, I'll try to do something about my drinking. And he said, I've been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous for over 10 years. Cully's been sober now 28 years. Paul hit on this last night, and I think maybe Nick did too. If we read in our big book, and we read in Bill's story, we read that Debbie Thatcher made a special trip to New York to tell Bill Wilson about the spiritual program he had found. It was keeping him sober. And after a bout with a bottle, Bill bought into this and tried to help these drunks. And he had no success, and Lois reminded him that he had been sober. And he goes to Akron, and on the Saturday afternoon before Mother's Day in 1935, he knew if he didn't find a drunk he would drink, he discovered the essence of our program. One drunk talking to another. That's the essence of what we do. And Bill discovered that, and after a lot of effort, he and Dr. Bob got together, and they found Bill Dodson, and the seeds of Alcoholics Anonymous were sown. One drunk talking to another. Until somebody got to Ned Hunter in Pennsylvania. And Ned was instrumental in my sobriety. Evidently, I lived my life in such a manner that when it came Cully's time, he knew where to go. And God only knows how many people Cully's been able to help. One drunk talking to another is like adding links to a chain. It gets longer and longer and longer, and we have encircled the globe and saved millions of men and women from a terminal illness of alcoholism, one drunk talking to another. Every morning when I ask for this morning's, or for this day's sobriety, ask God to let me help somebody today. I hope I've been able to do that this morning. God bless you.